Welcome to another episode of In the Name of Service, a podcast committed to sharing the untold stories of those who selflessly serve. Each episode features an interview with men and women who have been called to a variety of service-focused roles, such as the military, law enforcement, ministry, volunteering, and more. You aren't likely to know the names of the individuals you meet here, but our hope is by the end of our time together, you'll not only know their stories, but possibly be inspired to write your own in some way. Humble in nature, but strong in character, these everyday men and women showcase what it is to truly be a servant. We're glad you're here. Now here's your host, Dr. Barb Thompson.
All right. Thank you so much for joining me today for another inspiring episode of In the Name of Service. I'm your host, Dr. Barb Thompson. As a United States Army veteran and operational psychologist, I've spent my career working with military and law enforcement units, conducting in-depth interviews with individuals who are hoping to earn their place on high-risk, high-performing teams. In most cases, they've already put in years of grueling physical and mental work just to get a chance to serve and sacrifice more. And that type of selflessness is special, and I feel worthy of recognition. While each person's story is unique and every path to service different, their goals are similar: to do something bigger, to make an impact, to make a difference. And these difference makers were the catalyst behind this podcast. It's my privilege to share their stories with you. And especially today, I get to share my friend. I think I can call you a friend, even though we haven't seen each other for quite a while. We did work in the same office, which was kind of like a roller coaster at the time, but yeah. I'm grateful for it. So I want to introduce Chad McCoy. He was a PJ by training, but rose throughout the ranks of leadership, and lots and lots of wonderful attributes that I could talk about. I will first let him introduce himself, and he's going to do a better job than I will, and then you will see the attributes played out for yourselves as we talk through his story. Welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be reconnected with you and watch this process that you've been growing for the past, I guess, 30 something times, and continue to give back to other people, which is something I'm enamored by and grateful to you know, be talking with you and hopefully share a nugget or two that maybe be useful to somebody as stubborn as me.
For sure. So tell us, just so everyone listening knows, kind of your professional history and like where it has led you to this point so far.
Yeah, I grew up in Hawaii. Well, I went to school in Hawaii and joined the military out of there. Became a PJ right out of the gate, worked through the ranks to get to the unit that we served together at, and really found a home there. I found a mission that was really exciting for me. I think I felt fulfilled in purpose there for a long time, and I stayed for maybe longer than I should have. But yeah, I was a PJ the whole time. Ended up kind of reluctantly making rank through the process. And then in that reluctance to make rank, had to learn how to you know, lead, fumble through that, learn some things the hard way, grow a little bit, face some adversity in my career, which I'm happy to talk to you about. But I ended up getting out of the military, retired in 21. I took a job out of the military. I had a good job out of the military down here in the Panhandle of Florida. I was doing kind of a 9-to-5, wearing a suit and tie. Did that for a year, and then transitioned to joining a small business, so a startup with two other co-founders. And we started a 3D print drone company, and we're doing that. That's been the, you know, kind of the, it's not a 9-to-5, it's a 12-to-15 every day. But it's been a new sense of purpose, new team, a new mission. So, been good.
Awesome. Thank you for that. So, take us back, if you can. I know it's like a classic psychology question or psychologist question, but I do want people to hear about, from your perspective, the way that you grew up. Like, what are some experiences or relationships that shaped you, you think, into a person who wanted to do or could do, was capable of doing those hard things?
Yeah, I don't think there's any secret sauce in my life of something that gave me a special attribute. I was enamored by, like, I think like a lot of kids in my generation, a lot of, you know, young men in my, you know, kind of era of, you know, watching movies, you know, being enamored by commandos and doing this cool stuff. And, and then playing war out in the woods and, you know, building forests and throwing pine cones at each other. And I'll be honest, I think that kind of, that spark or interest grew into something that was attainable, right? And when I was in Hawaii, I wasn't smart enough to get a scholarship. I wasn't a star athlete. I wasn't ever going to school on a scholarship for sports. And so I had a choice. It was to join the military. And, you kind of get your pick in the late 90s where you're not at war. And so you get to assess things on kind of where you want to go. And, you know, PJs kind of had it all. You know, they got to do all the fun stuff right out of the gate, where it typically takes other like soldiers, sailors, whatever, a little bit longer to get to those, you know, kind of pinnacle schools. Now I know as a senior guy that schools aren't really what makes you special or what gets you, you know, to the mission. But back then, you know, those were badges of honor. They were kind of things that made you elite when you're a young guy. And I got to do them all right off the bat. And so that's kind of the why. I didn't have any special attributes. I was a surfer. I was comfortable in the water. Maybe that helped. But truthfully, I had to learn how to swim, like lanes. You know, I was great, hold my breath, but I probably couldn't swim a straight line if I tried to. So I had to learn.
You had already, I think, deployed like, I don't even know, more than a dozen times before I met you in 20. Is there any kind of seminal experience that, like, as you reflect back on your career, really sticks out for you?
Yeah, I had a lot of deployments. Not all of them were super exciting. You have the ones that are remarkable because maybe they're scary, maybe they're a great success, maybe you got to do, you know, something exciting, like save someone's life. I had deployed a few times to kind of other theaters before I went to the unit up there in North Carolina. They were unsatisfying. Like, I was doing alerts, you know, I was waiting for things to happen. And, you know, they're like kind of pseudo deployments, kind of like a vacation, honestly. You drink with your buddies, hanging out. You got these windows where you're on alert, providing the coverage. You kind of feel like you're special, but you're not, because you're not being tested. And I was going to get out of the military after 9/11 because I was in Okinawa and I wanted to go to war, and I was stuck up there. And that's probably a terrible way to frame it, but I was in a theater that was kind of nascent. We were doing OEFP, which is the OEF Philippines. They gave us the OEF moniker, but we didn't deserve it for what we were doing, in my estimation. But I was coming up on the end of my enlistment, and so I'd been to two units before, and I tried out for the unit at Bragg, and I told them in the board, I said, look, you guys can either take me or you won't. So if you don't, I'm getting out of the military, and I'm going to go work for Blackwater. And it wasn't a threat. It was just honest. It was like, I'm going to war one way or the other. I'll trust me in another service. I have to. Because I trained for years and I wanted to be tested. I wanted to know who I was. Some of that was my own insecurities, right? Like, I wanted to prove something to myself, like that I was good enough or tough enough.
Right.
And without that testing or that crucible, you just don't know. And I think that kind of eats guys up. And I think the guys are probably going through that now, because
for sure.
Same thing. You train, now you don't get to test it. So are you good enough, right? That's wrong. First on the security, we got to work through it. But you asked about, like a seminal event. I think that my first plum was cool, wasn't super eventful. And then I started going to these deployments and everything was eventful. And I had a kind of a weird run where every deployment would be these crazy events. And it was just like, at first I was like, oh, this is cool. This is how everyone's experience is. And then I sort of realized it wasn't. And, you know, there's a term for it, which I won't say on here because it's, you know, inappropriate, but like, you know, you become like this, well, some people call it mission magnet, but it's negative stuff, right? It's like tragedy happens on your deployment.
Right.
And so you're checking a block, you're getting the action, you're getting fights, you're getting tested, but you're also getting all the baggage that comes with it. And I think, one of the poems that really rocked me was, I'd been on a bunch of, and I got shot up real close and it didn't hurt me. And then it started messing with my head. It started making me think, like, well, why didn't it kill me? And then we started having tragedy in the unit where I had teammates getting killed and it wasn't happening to me. And then I went on another deployment to Afghanistan. I had rounds go all around me. Nothing hits me. And I'm like, and then you start thinking, what is my life? What's my purpose? Is it this? Is it, or am I going to die in the next deployment because I'm supposed to do that one?
Right.
And then just uncertainty comes into play. So I think that was like a point for me personally that I was like, man, this is heavy. I don't know why I'm not getting hurt, but it has to mean something. But I didn't know the meaning. So is that a good enough answer?
Yeah,
I don't know what year it was. Maybe that was 2009, maybe, or two. But then I just kept going. And and had kids, and life got a little bit harder to play. It was easy when I was single, you know.
Right.
No strings, didn't care if I lived or died. But.
And were you aware of that, like when you went out the door every time, of that first experience that you're talking about? Or did you share that with anyone? Or is that just something you carry the whole time and kind of put it to the side? Or
I shared it once with a guy that, you know, you and I both know, over some beers. But it almost kind of sounded like I was being almost like arrogant, you know. It was like, well, this is happening because I'm meant for something bigger. And it's like, who do you share that with? And in our environment at that unit, you know, everyone's high. They're all the best guys in the world, right?
Right. And so yeah, everybody
you don't want to be a guy to say, I'm meant for something bigger. Even though that doubt or that thought is in your mind, it's not necessarily appropriate to share. And even with close friends, because they're maybe dealing with different stuff. And so you keep everything locked in. That happens now. I mean, we were just talking about stuff that happens post-military. And guys lock some of the stuff up pretty tight. When I did share it, you know, we kind of laughed about it because it sounds so silly. And then I just wrote it off. I said, man, we'll see. But I had a bunch of other stuff happen later. And, you know, I had a gun go through my hand and not blow up. And I had all these random things happen. I was like, why is this not hurting me? I mean, I certainly got banged up along the way. But then you see people get really hurt, you know, friends like injured really badly or die. And it confuses you, I think, a little bit.
You mentioned your family. How many years in were you when you and Jeff got married and started to have kids?
Yeah. I'd been in for, I don't know, maybe 8 years, maybe. She did a bunch of deployments, you know, when we were engaged and then we got married, and it was null. That was all she knew. And so we didn't know it. That was just normal to us. It was harder when I stopped deploying than when I was deploying. I had kids towards the end of my, like, you know, kind of really heavy deployments. And then I was, you know, I got thrown into like upper management, which is a whole different kind of stress. Probably more stressful.
For sure. Yeah, yeah. Maybe worse. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of that, though, you handled it very differently. And I don't know if that's just like your, cause like it's going to be Chad's way. Like it's your personality. I know that you were intentional about your leadership because I saw you planning out like before, you know, those OTC students would come when we were at the debt, you know, like you trying to put this frame of mind around like where we want to take the culture there and how you want to change things for the better. But then I saw you, you know, as you moved up in rank even more so. I mean, what I was hearing about was like the kind of almost distrust of the command and the skepticism that the guys carried always. It's like they were always on guard, yeah. But we're at yeah. home. Like this is our home team. And
like
you
a bunch
somehow,
of abused children, yeah.
Yes, yeah, yes. But then you somehow changed that and they knew that you cared. And they started to trust. And so how'd you
yeah,
do that?
There's a couple of things there. Well, I don't know. I mean, the culture piece, like this is what really bothers me about the military right now is that these senior leaders talk about culture and it's like, it's a bumper sticker. It's not real. Culture is a real thing. You can feel it when you walk into an organization, you can sense it when you talk to people. You know, negative culture, positive culture, the whole bit. And one person doesn't get to change culture. You can't change it. Like you put me in leadership position, I don't change the culture. The guys on the teams change the culture. They're the ones that own it. You can empower them. You can hopefully bring them closer to kind of what your vision is. But if they don't buy into it, the culture remains. And in the military, the culture knows that it can survive leaders, right? Hey, Chad's here. We can wait him out. He'll be gone in a year or two. And that happens all the time. Every single unit commander comes in, we're going to change the world. And the guys are like, dude, we've been changing the world, man. We're burnt out. And, you know, then, you know, there's this kind of like, okay, we'll appease, we'll do just enough, but we ain't changing. And, so when I got to the debt, I didn't know how to be a leader. I was trying to do what other people did. Right. I was like, I saw guys who are awesome leaders to me. And I tried to behave like them earlier in my career when I was a troop chief. And it didn't fit. It wasn't authentic.
Right.
And so I asked a lot of people for help before I went over there. And Brett, you know, I replaced Brett over there. And Brett was killing it. And Brett's like a guy I respect, you know, still to this day. And I'm like, I can't be him. I'm not him. I'm an emotional guy, and I used to think it was a negative trait that I had, because it had been harped on me, like going through the selection, like, oh, you're over emotional and you get pissed off, or you get... And I'm like, yeah, I am emotional. And then I found out later in life, it was my superpower. Like, I care about people,
I
and I do get pissed off
know.
as well because I
It's
care.
just that that's
And
so much.
so I stopped trying to like suppress it, and I just embraced it. At the debt, I learned, and I had a small organization of people, big personalities, but super talented guys. And my job was to empower them. And I'm like, well, we got to change our mindsets a bit. And you got studs like Trey was over there, and Trey is a big picture guy. He's looking at organizational culture and like, how do you get to, and he's also a master manipulator too. He's manipulating me all the time. But I was like, okay, so I can change this here at a smaller scale. And I try without being overpowering, but I also had to recognize that these guys are professionals and I'm not the expert anymore, so back away. And then when I went to 2-4 as a chief, I was like, man, this place feels off. I walked through the halls there and I was like, this place feels negative, and I just it was like a heavy feeling on me. And here I was, an outsider, and no one trusted me. I came from a different squadron where they were like, oh, well, he's gonna take away all our toys. And I'm like, I don't want to do that. I want to be good to you guys. And there was complete distrust of all leadership. And here I was, I'm like, I was a good operator, but here I was in charge. And a bunch of people didn't even know my background, didn't, because it's not like, oh, it's that guy. And so one of the, I don't know if you remember this, one of the first things I did was, I took off the doors. It's kind of like a symbol, like that we need to, like, I want you guys communicating. This can't be true. I mean, you guys have tribes. You're always going to have that. That's okay. But I don't want to be so exclusionary. Like, we're, I guess it's cliche to say you're a family as an organization on the business side, but it is a family. It's a tribe. You have tribes within there. They care for your family. Your families know each other. Like, it's as tight as a family. But outside of those team rooms, there was no crosstalk or relationships. It obviously happens to go to church together, or your kids are in school together, whatever. But, and it wasn't supposed to be symbolic. It was like, I truly wanted us to communicate. And it took guys a really long time to like realize I wasn't full of crap. But when we talk about culture, it takes so much time to build trust, because trust is the central equation in all this. And if you screw up one time, you lose it all. And so the stakes are really high. And so I was doing the debt and the 2-4 for a while, and it was burning me out. I was driving up an hour and a half one way to go home. And I'd get home and talk to my wife, and I was like, I don't know how to do this. And I just realized that I just had to be authentic. And I had to just care about people. The people that I could, affect were the troop chiefs, the people I can empower, the troop chiefs. And that's what I tried to do. I made a ton of mistakes along the way. But I was genuine in my attempt to do it. And in the process, I got to grow a lot. And so I got to kind of, grow into the role. And then obviously I had a dramatic, the rug got pulled out of me at the end. But if you diagnose culture, I think I could objectively say that it improved. At least from my senior position on the ground with the guys, it's hard to get a real answer because people tell you what you want to hear in those positions. But I hope their life improved a little bit. I hope they knew that leaders would have their back. And then when I had to leave, it was hard for me because I felt like I left a lot of things unfinished, and I still really cared deeply about all the guys. And even if you're not friends with every guy in the unit, that's a misnomer. Like, you have people you just don't get along with, but I cared about them just the same. And but yeah, so that's, I don't know if I answered your question. Talk about a lot of stuff just then, like I usually do.
Now that I think that was really helpful, because in my mind it was a question like, how much is it just that he showed up as himself, or was he following a playbook of some kind? And I think it's more attainable for the person listening to say, like, when you really care enough, then showing up as yourself is probably gonna get you the farthest. So.
You still got to be good, right? You still got to have skills. You still got to be able to, you got to do the job. And I was like, I'll tell you this now, I'm going to retire, doesn't matter. I was a reluctant, like, chief. I was a reluctant, I kind of stumbled into making E9. I think all the senior leaders were like, holy crap, that must have been a typo. And I was like, okay, well, cool. I was like, I don't really care about the rank on my shoulder. I care about the job I got. And they gave me this job, and this is a heavy one. And I was like, I don't know how the hell to do it, but I'm going to figure it out. And so when I weighed in, I had no intentions of like, I didn't want to make E10. And I think once people started realizing that I never politicked to get the position, that holy crap, man, maybe we can't trust this guy. But the problem is that the other thing that senior leaders face within those organizations is that you're an operator in one life, and that life is not your life as a senior leader, unfortunately. And yeah, you could have been a, you know, you could have been a wild child on this side. You don't get to do that as a senior leader. And some people have a hard time looking past the fact, okay, this is your previous life and this is who you are now. And some people call you a sellout. You do it. They're like, you can't be the raging operator that was an E5 as an E9. It's just, it's oil and water. It doesn't work. You would burn everything down around you and you wouldn't get anywhere.
Exactly.
And so there's a level of maturity that guys have to realize that it's, yeah, you are different. You don't get to be the same. You don't get to drink with the guys anymore for a good reason. So.
Yeah. Before we pressed record, I mentioned that unit as being the pinnacle for an Air Force operator anyway. And, you know, it is like they get into the Air Force, especially if they go into some kind of aspect war type of FSC, and they work and work and work to get to that point. And for them, at least at that time, that's as high as life gets, right? Like that is their, that's the bucket list. And, and you said that's not the pinnacle. And anyway,
well, they're artificial, I would love, like,
yeah,
they're artificial, like levels of achievement. Yeah, for sure. Like you have to work hard to get here. You have to be this to get here. So there's a perception that you are the best. And okay, so objectively, they're probably the most skilled. I don't know if they're in the best shape. There's some guys in studs, but there's also studs in the regular units. There's also excellent operators of the regular units that never even want to come up there. And so what you end up doing is you start drinking your own Kool-Aid. But then you're also isolated up there. But one thing I've noticed as I got out of the military is that the military is very, by design, it's very linear. And that is what screws guys up on the outside, is that if I do this, I get to here, right? There's nothing in the business world that's like that.
Right.
Like on the outside, it's choose your adventure. And it's like this giant Chinese menu of options. You can do whatever the hell you want. And if you do this, doesn't mean you're going to go here. You might actually go down two steps. In the military, it's like, if I keep my nose clean, I do this, I go here. Cool. Now I've made E9, so I've made it to the top, so I win. Well, that's not how it works outside. You know, you could become an entrepreneur and hit it big and make a ton of money. And you're like, no, I'm going to do it again. I want to make more money. You know, there's no pinnacle of achievement. And without those guide rails and the frameworks, it's scary for guys. It's scary for me because I was like, well, what's my purpose going to be? Is it going to be my job? Is it some level of attainment? Is it financial? Is it personal? And the military makes it very concrete. But it also institutionalizes people to that mindset and how they approach problems and how they approach success. And I think it becomes an impediment for some people.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Because you think there's only one way to skin a cat, and they say.
Yeah.
I want to talk about, if you're willing, and I didn't ask you this beforehand, so
what you want to talk about?
I'll edit it out if you don't want to talk about it. But you and Jess are still married, and that is quite the exception, you know, to the rule in, you know, special operations community. So say whatever you want to say about that, but I'd love to hear about it.
Yeah, I mean, I was a really selfish guy when we first got married. It was all about me, and she just kind of put up with me. And I believe that, you know, Jess and I were destined to be together and be married, and like her to go through the hard years with me so that I can learn how to be a gentleman on the other end. I certainly wasn't when I was in the military, and it's all about me. And you know, you gotta be, you know, part of the process to make me successful, you know, whether that be putting up with my TDYs or deployments. And when I got out of the military, life was hell with us relationship. And I was going through a lot, just mentally, like struggling with my purpose. And I really struggled with, which I didn't know at the time, but like everything seemed great to me. And I was like, everything is great. There's no like joy. There's no, I was angry. I wasn't happy. And I was like, is this what life is? And I literally looked myself in the mirror one day. I was like, I have to live what 40, 50 more years of this crap. And I like had that discussion with myself. I was like, I'm going to be bored to death. I mean, when am I going to get scared? And I didn't realize that I was, and I think maybe guys realize this, maybe they're smarter than me, but I was like, I didn't realize it was going to be a factor. And then I started looking at my life and my relationships, and I was like, I was bored. And then I started to just like kind of distance myself. And we had a rough first year of the military. You know, it was on me. It was, I would say it was 90-10, me. And you know, she's, and you know my wife, she's put me for a long time, and she continued to. And then I had the realization after, you know, some soul searching, that she was really the rock that had kept me kind of, kept me together, had been the consistency that I needed in relationships with people. She'd always been there and never kind of faltered. I was being the prick all the time. And I'm not saying that's the same in everybody's relationship, but like for me, it was. And I have, you know, kind of, I think this is probably why old people renew their vows, man. But like, for me personally, we're in a good spot where, we still argue. Obviously everyone does. I'm still stubborn. I'm still probably in the deep down sci-fi thing of the center of the universe, but, I'm really working hard to be better and to be what she deserves, not just what I deserve. And so yeah, hopefully we continue to be that success story. I mean, I'm sure we'll have a hiccup here this afternoon.
Like us all. Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah. You, tell us about Firestorm a little bit more, if you will, because you guys seem to be blowing up literally.
Well, nothing's blown up yet. Yeah, so we started. So I got introduced to a couple of guys out of California when I'd left my last job. I committed to in 12 months, and I told Jess I'm going to quit, and maybe I'll just be retired for a few months. And I got this phone call from these guys, introduced through a buddy of mine, and they're like, "Yeah, we're going to build this low cost cruise missile, and we need a military guy to be with us in this, and like help us productize it." And I was like, I just came from working, you know, weapons systems with the Air Force, and you know, my former corporate job. And I was like, there's a lot of big companies that do this really well, and I don't think that there's a space for it. So when we started exploring the technology, I realized that, holy crap, we got something special. And so I joined these guys as the third co-founder, and we have a 3D printed drone that we can print in 9 hours. It's a jet. So it's not like a little quadcopter. It's a jet, 6 foot by 6 foot, assembles like a Lego set, and we'll do a lot of different missions. One will be to blow up, like you described. One of them will be to, you know, look at targets. There's also a lot of humanitarian roles that I'm really excited about. I went to India last year as a G20 delegate and was talking to them about some of the infrastructure requirements that India has, not only just for agriculture, but for assessments. And like, this is just a tool, right? And we have that, and we have manufacturing. So I kind of bowled the ocean last year, learning how to be in a small business, learning it. There's no playbook. I mean, there is a playbook. I just didn't read it. and usually you have a mentor, and like, I have mentors on the side that helped me for sure, like with the kind of high level business stuff, but the grind was all kind of thrown on me. And then I decided that I couldn't do it alone. And I've always been better with good teams around me. And that's when I brought on our mutual friend. He's been just absolutely killing it.
It's exciting. So normally at the end of every episode, I will ask my guest the same question. And that's like, if someone is listening and they already feel this urge to change the world, you know, like, what is your advice for them? But with you, I want to do it a little bit differently and ask you three questions to end with. So sorry, you get the extra.
Yeah, like 30 minutes for me to answer.
The first one is, you've had a lot of rough days. I mean, and in the military, out of the military, whether it's personal, relational, or professional, how and what would you say keeps you going? Because you are obviously, like, your drive is off the charts.
It's not healthy. Yeah. My drive when I was in the military is very different from my drive now. And my drive in the military, I was proving something to this deep needed void in my life when I was in. I seemed like a young boy who was trying to prove something to the world, right? And I was that as a 40-year-old, you know, still doing what I was doing. And I have always been a believer, but lukewarm at best, you know, and, you know, kind of was saved, but was just living for whatever the hell I wanted. And I started doing middle school ministry in North Carolina with some young boys, and it kicked me in the butt because I was like, holy crap, like this is my accountability right now. I'm not even doing things I'm asking them to do. And that was the start of my kind of transformation in a positive way, is that I was telling them to read the word. I wasn't reading it myself. And so I dedicated myself from that moment to every morning I read the Bible, and it's continuous. And so I've just been powering through every verse, you know, every morning. And then it became routine. So I'm like, now I need it. You know, I drink coffee and read the Bible and read my devotional. But I still hadn't changed my life. Still very self-centered. It was about me. I think I got seduced a little bit by some of the stuff going on, like, you know, with people finding different ways to be spiritual. And I was curious, and I was big into meditation. I'm like, oh, I'm going to find some kind of attainment. But at the end of the day, what it came down to was my submission to my Creator. And like, my relationship with Christ has never been better. That is what keeps me aligned now. If this job goes away, I'm okay. Like, everything I own goes away, I'm okay. And I'm not saying that in a like a trivial way. I'm able to lead my family, and that's my number one priority, being a good role model to my kids, learning how to be a good husband to my wife so my kids can see it, and then branching out from that little ecosystem to my neighborhood, my neighbors, my friends, friends that I haven't connected with in a while, reaching out to them, being good to them, not being so selfish. Like, but that's how I'm staying aligned, is that I'm living for something that's amazing. It's profound, and it is not old words in a book. It's really kicked my ass and in a really, really good way. So that's my answer.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's a fire that doesn't go out. So the second question is, before we talk to people who maybe want to jump in and want to start kind of like full force, like taking some action on serving in some capacity, talk to the guys who are still in. Like, what are your words of advice for this? Speaking from the other side. No.
Well, I don't ever poison the well with what they have in front of them. They've got a tough road right now. And so I would never detract from that, because they have to take care of each other. And I get really disappointed when I see guys that I love getting out, because people need leaders right now. And
right.
So in lieu of the leader that you want, be that. The other piece is like succession planning is, you know, we talk about in the military a lot, but you need a little tribe of people that you're growing too. And I still have some folks that are still in that I bet on, right? And they're the guys that I want to be successful. They're still in. I need them to stay in. I need them to be what I can't be anymore. But I think that obviously we're not talking about geopolitics right now, but like there's conflict looming, and, you know, real tried and true leadership is going to be essential, because it's going to be really tough. It's going to be the toughest fight they've ever fought. And so, you know, what I think they should be doing or thinking about, I think, you know, you get a little bit from leadership books, but candidly, it's experiential. It's finding, knowing who you are personally, and then magnifying that by 1,000.
Yes.
It's being yourself. If you're an emotional wreck like me, embracing it, using it to your advantage. But I think there's also balance. If I said caring deeply, I think it'd be misconstrued, because I think there's also the element of like tough love too. We have to let people fail. You have to empower them to get back up, and people need to kind of learn some stuff the hard way. I know I did. So.
Right. Yeah. Love it. Okay. Now, if someone is listening to your story, you know, maybe they're not in the military, maybe they are, who knows, but they're feeling that urge that you still feel to change the world. I know you do. And this is from a conversation years ago, but you're like, is it silly? You know, like I want to be a superhero, and not to trivialize that, like that feeling of wanting to change the world, that's real. And I believe that everyone on earth who has breath was born on purpose for a purpose, and they're all going to be feeling that urge, and many ignore it. But what advice do you have for the person who they have that, but they're not quite sure like where or how to get started?
I think manage your expectations. I mean, changing the world isn't necessarily, you know, being in front of everything and I'm being the guy. Maybe it's somebody behind the scenes. And, you know, I know that you've had some great folks in your conversations that have been support folks. And those support folks are the ones that hyper-enable the operators to do what they do. And so it's, I guess, maybe change your expectations or your definition of what success is. Because my definition of success on this side is very different. Like I told you before, maybe it's just one relationship I'm going to have, you know, post-military that's going to change their life for the better. I'm okay with that. That's changing the world. That's changing their world for sure. Mm-hmm. I think that we have a tendency, especially as operators or former operators, have a tendency of thinking that has to be like this grandiose achievement.
Right. Yes.
And we've been conditioned to like, you know, be pat on the head like little dogs and given our, you know, our BSM and we're happy with ourselves and we're proud. But the truth is that sometimes the guys that are making the most impact, the guys that never get a pat on the head, no one ever even sees it. And I needed to understand that because when I got out of the military, I wanted to go help all these orphans in Ukraine. I went over there and I was going to change the world and fill my bucket, you know, for lack of a better term. And I didn't. And I felt even worse when I came home because like I didn't do anything. And I was like, I thought I was going to go save a bunch of kids' lives and that'll make me happy. And then I started to realize that.
You hit a good point right there. Yep.
Well, I could just keep chasing like this level of attainment that I'm never going to get to. And so.
Right. For you.
Yeah, for me. Yeah. And, but I'm also like realizing that I'm also capable and when people come to me, I can help them.
Right.
And it might be something that seems trivial now, but it's not. And so I guess that's what it is. It's expectation management. It's framing kind of your goals, something achievable. That's important. that's my answer.
Yeah, I love it. There's all kinds of things right in front of you.
Yeah. Yeah, and it could be, it could be in your house. It could be with your kids. And so I'm going to take it one day at a time. And, you know, if I get tested or, you know, God's will drives me a different direction, I'll be obedient to it, hopefully. Hopefully I don't forget and run away. But those tests might be way harder than being shot at. They might be full submission. Might be sucking it up and doing a job you don't want to do. So
100%. That's it for today. I know there's a lot more, but yeah. I think cool. I think I try to keep these, you know, to an amount of time where no one will watch it for sure. Hopefully a few people will listen to it.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much. It's exciting to see what you're doing. It's exciting to see who you are becoming. And that's
I'm all grown up.
Anyway, thanks for what you've done and what you continue to do. And thank you for being with us during this time.
Awesome. Thanks, Barb.
Hey, everybody. Thank you for joining us for another incredible episode of In the Name of Service. If you enjoyed today's episode, please like and subscribe. And of course, feel free to share with those you feel would like to be inspired. Have a difference maker in your life that you'd like to see featured? Reach out to Dr. Barb Thompson at inthenameofservice@gmail.com. We'll see you next time.